أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أستغفر الله ربي وأتوب إليه اللهم أغنى بالعلم وزينا بالعلم وأكرمنا بالتقوى وجملنا بالعافية صلى الله عليه وسلم السلام عليكم my dear brothers and sisters JazakAllah for the conference organizers to Sheikh Maqbool and everybody for giving me the very humble opportunity to address you today. As was advertised, I would like to talk about how Letter 31 in Hajj al-Balagha can be offer a holistic model for madrasa education. And before I go into that, I want to just briefly say why I'm embarking on this particular project and paper. One is, when we look at Nahj al-Balagha, it's often seen as a book of literature, as a book of spirituality, in fact, as a book of containing many things, book of politics, for example, sermons about the Quran. But it has rarely been seen as a book of frameworks. That means if you are to open any book and you are to say, what principles can I use and build a model, or in the philosophical sense, upbuild from the book, in my humble view, I don't think it has been looked like that. That if we open the book, can we extract certain models or frameworks which give us guidance for our various problems? It could be in leadership. It could be in the way we look at the Quran. It could be, as the topic is today, madrasa education. So I want to perhaps look at Nahj al-Balagha in a different way. Why have I chosen madrasa education? Well, by madaris or schools, I mean the faith school, voluntary school, part-time and full-time, that is usually taught on a Saturday or Sunday, or sometimes, as we have a few here in the UK, which is taught 5 days a week. And we teach fiqh and akhlaq and Quran and tariq. That is what I mean by madaris. And there's a reason why I have chosen this. Because since British Muslims migrated, or since Muslims migrated to this country in the 1950s, we have, it is reported, 111 schools in this country, Shia and Sunni, and we have 14,000 students. However, we have been operating on the same model of madrasa education for the last 50 years, which, as you know, involves this classical division of fiqh and akhlaq, tajweed, Quran, etc., with some issues of aqaid there, and perhaps now Arabic is being taught. My question for this next 20-25 minutes is this vision or this division that we have sufficient for our evolving needs as Muslims? And I'm not talking about Shia one. In Nahj al-Balagha can be offer a holistic model for madrasa education. And before I go into that, I want to just briefly say why I'm embarking on this particular project and paper. One is, when we look at Nahj al-Balagha, it's often seen as a book of literature, as a book of spirituality, in fact, as a book of containing many things, book of politics, for example, sermons about the Quran. But it has rarely been seen as a book of frameworks. That means, if you are to open any book, and you are to say, what principles can I use and build a model, or in the philosophical sense, upbuild from the book, in my humble view, I don't think it has been looked like that. That if we open the book, can we extract certain models or frameworks which give us guidance for our various problems? It could be in leadership. It could be in the way we look at the Quran. It could be, as the topic is today, madrasa education. So I want to perhaps look at Nahj al-Balagha in a different way. Why have I chosen madrasa education? Well, by madaris or schools, I mean the faith school, voluntary school, part-time and full-time, that is usually taught on a Saturday or Sunday, or sometimes, as we have a few here in the UK, which is taught 5 days a week. And we teach fiqh and akhlaq and Quran and tariq. That is what I mean by madaris. And there's a reason why I have chosen this. Because since British Muslims migrated, or since Muslims migrated to this country in the 1950s, we have, it is reported, 111 schools in this country, Shia and Sunni, and we have 14,000 students. However, we have been operating on the same model of madrasa education for the last 50 years, which, as you know, involves this classical division of fiqh and akhlaq, tajweed, Quran, etc. With some issues of aqaid there, and perhaps now Arabic is being taught. My question for this next 20-25 minutes is this vision or this division that we have sufficient for our evolving needs as Muslims? And I'm not talking about Shia Muslims, I'm talking about all human beings, as I believe letter 31 is quite universal. Is this sufficient, number one? Number two, what can this letter offer us in giving us perhaps a new vision, maybe which we haven't thought of? These are the two questions which I want to actually focus on. And I do humbly understand that there are people that say, well, we should search for Muslim education because we can never get to Islamic education. If you say Muslim education, it means a plethora of Muslim interpretations. But I still believe there is a noble task of trying to find out some foundational values of what we mean by Islamic education, rather than simply saying Muslim education, as I know that these views kind of exist. Of course, whichever side you want to be on, but I'm trying to search for foundational values. The themes of letter 31 are quite obvious even if you have read the letter. But I think it's a harder task to actually extract these themes in an intellectual sense. As a brief example, the spiritual and secular worldviews are discussed in the letter, the idea of reflecting about civilizations and about the world, as well as Allah Himself. The idea of seeking God for guidance, the idea of character building, the idea of having patience over adversities, the idea of repentance, the idea of creativity, and many more are discussed in this letter, telling us that this letter, which as some of you know, was a letter written in the latter part of Imam Ali al-Islam's life to his son either Al-Hasan al-Islam or Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, that this letter, although you can say, well, is a letter about family advice, well, family advice is a useful tool, because if you talk about any educational institution, you're talking about the relationship between a teacher and a child. And the values that are imparted are going to be central to that person's life. So I thought to myself, this is an appropriate place to start in Nahjul Balagha. There are other sermons and letters which are relevant, but I do feel this letter encompasses these things. Salawat, please. When you go to academic conferences, you can't really say salawat and have a bit of a break and think. So at least I can say that today. It makes me think about my thoughts further. Before I discuss this letter, we have to contextualize it. I have identified three trends which I humbly feel are affecting all Muslims and arguably all human beings today in education. And I mean education in the broadest sense. Commercialization, politicization, and secularization. What is commercialization? Well, I don't need to tell you what has been happening over the last 2 years with how university education has become very instrumental. That means high student fees, that you study, you go to university to get an A or 2-1 or whatever it is to get a job. The idea that the university is connected to the private sector. The idea that the university is there to also serve the state. What has been happening is education and knowledge itself is not necessarily studied for knowledge's sake, for self-improvement as such, but it is now explicitly connected to monetary and financial life, and luxury in fact. And therefore, when you are there to educate yourself, you are there to provide a happy and luxurious and stable life for yourself. Let me just give you a quote by Kostas Duzinas. He's a professor at Birkbeck University. And he has actually commented on this. He says, like many others, I believe that it is time for intellectuals and academics to join the wider political and cultural debates of the time and bring whatever limited insights we can offer to work for a better world. Now, there is this idea that the academic, the scholar within the Hawza or the university is somehow disconnected to the society. So he continues. Too often, we academics, we scholars, have opted for a life of accommodation and non-confrontation, looking to the next promotion or book contract. Too often has the university slavishly served the demands of the state, nation, and ideology. And yet the prime mission of the university remains the quest for knowledge and truth, which is arguably what perhaps all educational institutions should strive for. As we know, since Socrates, knowledge and truth are the inseparable partners of justice and beauty. Truth and knowledge are wedded to justice. Speaking truth with justice to power is the name and honor of the European University. Now, what he says is actually rather bold, and not many people say it like that. To put that in a university context, or in a book, and to teach that in a lecture, somehow it raises certain eyebrows, because you're going against the current commercialization and educational process of the university. So just keep that trend in mind. I will relate it to the madrasa. Then you have the issue of politicization, which means what? You have the Eurocentricism or Euro-Americanization of knowledge. So for example, take this, the way we are doing the conference today in a hotel, okay? The way that you teach in a university, the way that you have conference packs, all right? The way that you have a textbook in a university, that you have to study Kant, or you have to study this Hoza text, whether it is or a Fiqhi text, doesn't matter, there's no distinction between East and West here. The idea that you have a textbook as such comes from the idea that you ground a university or educational process in an ideology, whether that ideology is positive or negative. So how many of us have thought that whether the textbook that we have studied over the last 50 years or our mode of education has affected our mindset today? So when we say Eurocentricism, it is the analysis of European and American modes of educational learning which have seeped into all types of spheres and which are either positively or negatively affecting us today. Take the university as an example. You have Islamic studies, which is usually studied now in universities, and especially it has grown over the last 10 years. How do we study Islamic studies in universities? Early life history of the Prophet, yes? Then certain aspects of Hadith and Ilm al-Rijal. Then you continue on, and maybe you will go on to women's studies or some contemporary issue. And you may also look at Ghazali and Ibn Sina and Mullah Sadr, etc. Is that particular framework of Islamic studies in itself beneficial to the study of Islam? That's the question I'm posing to you. Because that framework hasn't necessarily come as such from an original conception of Islam, but as an also influence from Euro-American knowledge, so that you compartmentalize certain periods of Islamic studies. You see that? Now, I can go more into that, but there's no time. But I'm just giving you a seed of, you can see that systems of knowledge which guide us are also influential in the way we look at our religion and the way we conduct ourselves today. Then you have secularism. Now, you have a distinction between secularism and secularization, some of you know. Secularism is an ideology that God should be divorced from life, and from public life especially. But secularization, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, is simply the severance or the divorce of state and religion. Not necessarily religion shouldn't always be involved in politics as such, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But what this has led, or what this has happened in universities and in schools, is now, if you want to tell somebody what is inspiration, what is ilham, what is God, what is revelation, that's very difficult to do today in United Kingdom, which is the context which I'm focusing on. Because education has become divorced from spiritual modes of learning. And the biggest idea which I can point you for that, which is now there's a change in secular education in the last 10 years, Stephen Bigger has written on the notion that there should be spiritual secular education. What is spiritual secular education? He said that actually today, students in secular education, and I went to two Christian schools, went to grammar school, etc., yet also going to madrasa, so I could see the dichotomy. This is perhaps what most students today are growing up in. That you have a religious instruction on the one side, and then when you go to school, all of that religious instruction is divorced. So you have a dichotomized madrasa student, essentially, right? So what Stephen Bigger is suggesting, which I do agree with to some degree, but there are some issues I have contention with, he says that how can you train a student today to appreciate creativity, inspiration, and the center of the universe? Now, he doesn't use God in any of his analysis. What he's trying to tell us, because he believes religion leads to dogmatism, which I don't agree with fully, but he says schools today should have a system which combines secularization and spirituality, will teach a student how he should be the center of the universe. What is his mode of creativity? What can he contribute to society? Now today, if you look at Irfan, we do teach those things. We teach how a student or a child or any student in the Hawza should have an enduring relationship with Allah. What I'm trying to say is that even secular education today is realizing its own limitations. And we, as Shia Muslims, can use Najwa Balagha to provide an education, not just an education system, not just to ourselves, but for other human beings. Salawat, please. How does this relate to madrasas in the United Kingdom and maybe in other parts of the world? Well, if you look at the classical division which we have been using, and may I say at this point, I do humbly commend and respect the dear elders and the parents who, since migrating to this country, have built the madrasas, have built the mosques, have come up with this system, because without this system, I could not be standing here discussing maybe what I feel should be in the next 50 years. So I do want to make this very humble point. However, the challenges are of course very different. And maybe some of our respected elders and scholars here would also appreciate that. I have grown up also appreciating some of these challenges. This classical division looks at Islam in this way, that you have fiqh. And fiqh does what in the madrasa? It teaches a student to validly observe the performance of certain ritual obligations, salah and song, zakat and khums. So it teaches the child that you have to perform this particular obligation in order to validate yourself as a Muslim legally. That's essentially what it does. I'm not, by the way, making a judgment here. I'm just telling you what the instruction is meant to accomplish. Then you have tariq. And what does tariq do? It teaches you incidents. Battle of Badr, Ghadir al-Khum, Battle of Uhud, others. And that teaches the child to look at history in terms of periods and incidents, not in terms of an overarching concept or as an overarching theme to understand humanity. It's taught in terms of incidents. Then you have Quran. And as we know, how is Quran taught? Essentially Tajweed. That you teach the makharij, that you teach memorization of surahs, really the content of the Quran. And you also have akhlaq, and how is akhlaq taught? You teach narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, for example, or if you are in the Sunni madrasa, more so on the companions of the Prophet, right? So therefore, akhlaq is taught in terms of a hadith. So therefore, if you teach narrations, you are teaching sayings, right? So what do you extract from that? Does a person have an ethical vision of how to live? Okay, you're taught not to backbite, taught not to be jealous. But if you then take that person and say, right, now I'm going to the cinema, I'm going to the school, I'm watching this program, how do these narrations, which don't have much context, these narrations have to have a link, suddenly, to somebody living in 21st century Britain and is now engaging in different social contexts. So akhlaq is taught in terms of narrations, not in terms of an ethical vision or context. Do you see that? That is how essentially we teach. That is how I teach on Saturdays in Chelmsford. Yes? Now, how has commercialization, politicization and secularization forced us to look at the madrasa education differently? And these are the problems we're grappling with. If you look at commercialization, if ilm previously perhaps was taught or looked at upon as a noble activity. I'm studying knowledge to remove my ignorance, to look at my life in a better way. Then, what does a madrasa student think? I am going into madrasa in order to learn this particular legal obligation or this narration. And that is it. And my education instruction will end when I'm 15 or 16. Right? But then there comes a deeper question. Hold on a second. I'm going to school. So if I'm going to school, that's providing me a very wonderful education. So if my educational position ends at 18, and my madrasa education ends at 15, so I've accomplished what I want to accomplish. And now the young student would ask this question as I asked. What's the difference between secular education and Islamic education? What's secular education offering me? And what's Islamic education offering me? Isn't secular education offering me enough?
because it's offering me an educational instruction which also ends at a particular age. What's the difference? At the end of the day, I'm also going to secure a job and a life and I'm going to get married. How does Islamic education actually help me there? Because secular education is helping me directly attain my practical needs. You see that? So now, because of commercialization, education or madrasa education is looked at instrumentally. This is one particular challenge. There are many, but I'm just giving you one. Then you have politicization of knowledge and Euro-American knowledge. Which education system is better and what's guiding me in my conduct, essentially? Because what part of knowledge will I use in the rest of my life? Of course, the predominant system of knowledge which attends to my practical needs. But then you have another question. If I have fiqh, and if I have history, let's take history for example. How does my history differ to other forms of Muslim histories which are also valid anyway? So if you have that, what ideology and systems of knowledge are governing the student at that particular instance? And does the British history and the American history with civil rights movement, with Malcolm X and many of these things, does that play a role in madrasa education today? In fact, why don't I learn my ideology from Malcolm X? I'm not by the way saying what's positive and negative. I'm posing a question that comes naturally in a student's mind. So now, which history trumps the other? Malcolm X is a very revolutionary person, wonderful person, especially towards the end of his life. Or Imam Ali alayhi salam? Well, I don't see much difference either way. So I think that's a harder question to answer. Secularization. Well, I did give you the example of spiritual secular education. But today, especially when you go to university, you have a range of spiritualities. And there are now a number of books written on this subject. So the student, the question the student will ask is, what does my spirituality offer which is different to the spirituality of the Buddhist or the other type of Muslim or the humanist, etc.? And maybe there's similarities in all of them, no problem. But what are the differences? In fact, my father and mother told me to become Shia. So what makes me different? What is unique to my identity? That maybe other people have different identities. What's the difference? These are three trends which are now forcing madrasa educators, teachers and children to ask themselves these questions. So on. What has been our response so far? The response has been to replicate the models of secular education, essentially. So we focus on curricular development, teaching resources, teaching training, group discussions, leadership development. This is basically what we do to rectify these problems. In my humble view, these are very external processes because they don't look at the vision of Islamic education itself. You can have as many curriculum development processes as possible. However, what do we want? What do we want from madrasa in the 21st century? That's the tough question. And in fact, if you look at people like Carl Rogers says that a teacher should not feel that he's manipulating human robots. A teacher has to think, what are the human needs in the classroom and the human needs later on? Until he looks at his own values and his own vision, he will not be able to instruct anybody else. Yeah, and Carl Rogers was a very revolutionizing sort of educator. So now we come on to letter 31. 5 minutes left, but I had to give you that context. I've used this letter by looking at it in terms of what holistic way it can build a model, not just for Muslims, but for other religions and even secular education. Let me give you some principles, okay? Salawat, please. Now, I have some translations here and things like that, but I can't give you the conciseness of the language and things, but I'll try. Imam al-Islam begins the letter by telling his son, I advise you to be conscious of Allah, fulfill his commands, fill your heart with his remembrance and cling to his rope. For the rope is more trustworthy than any rope between you and God. Enliven your heart with exhortations. Observe the misfortunes of the world. Fear the authority of the time, the severity of the changing nights and days. Place it before the events of the past. Recall what happened to people before you. Just giving you a flavor. What is Imam trying to do? He's combining observation and analysis of the world and what happens in the world with remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Do we do that in madrasa education today? Do we combine dunyawi, if you like, sciences with our fundamental, if you like, hawzawi sciences? Do we do that? So what happens? We then train a dichotomized individual. I have religious instruction on the one hand, which is disconnected to worldly sciences like sociology and wider history. But I will learn that in school anyway. You see that? But Imam Ali is combining the two views and doesn't make this kind of distinction which we make today. A second example. Do we teach problem solving and meditation in the madrasa? He advises his son, if your soul refuses to accept my advice without gaining knowledge, imagine giving this freedom to a student, then know that your search for that should be with understanding and learning, not with the entanglement of doubts and trapping of quarrels. I'm trying to extract relevant principles that can attend to our needs today. He's clearing his son of doubts, and doubts can plague anybody. So if you develop a confident student as such, can you imagine what he can accomplish and the logical clarity with which he can think? One or two more examples. He says, وَفَتْحَ لَكَ بَابَ الْمَتَابِ وَبَابَ الْإِسْتِعْتَابِ فَإِذَا نَادَيْتَهُ سَمِعَ نِدَاكَ وَإِذَا نَجَيْتَهُ عَلِمَ نَجْوَاكَ. He has opened, God has opened for you the door of repenting, the door of reproach. So when you call upon Him, He hears your call. And when you whisper to Him, He knows your whisper. Do we develop an intimate connection in students with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? That intimate connection where there is a problem, that person can ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What about teaching supplication classes as such? One or two further examples before I end. Imam Ali says, habituate yourself to develop patience over adversities. Today, students suffer from depression, even at the time of exams. And if you find many reports, it is one of the most common illnesses as such today. Can you not teach a student that if he loses his mother or father, if he's having drug issues, if he's having isolation issues, if he cannot make friends, shouldn't the madrasa teach those things? Where else will he go anyway or she go? These are some, thank you very much, okay? These are some examples I'm giving you. Just to show you how letter 31 can connect to our needs, I'm going to end with a story, and it'll only take 1 minute. Where I teach part-time at the university, I have to teach theology and religious studies, and I teach a particular Islamic studies module. And as I've explained to you, I have to go through the various periods, Sirah and Ghazali and all these sorts of things. At one point, I stopped the class, and I just asked them, why are you here? Why are you actually studying theology and religious studies at the university? So some of them said, well, you know, I want to get a good degree, I'm interested in it, it just came natural to me, etc. Then I asked them another question. I said, is it meaningful for you to engage in a quest where you understand yourself, self-discovery, where you want to find out more about yourself, you know, spiritual quest, if you like? And all of them said yes, all of them. Said, yeah, we do want to know about our existence. They said, do you feel that theology and religious studies and the Islamic studies module does that for you? And they go, no, not really. So I said, would you benefit if next week, instead of teaching you this particular thing, I taught you some sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam, or some poetry of Rumi, where that may benefit you, but also you can critically think about it. And they all said yes. It is my contention that madrasa education is going down the same path as the theology and religious studies education of university, because we are not attending to the basic fundamental needs of students, and we're not connecting those needs to a dynamic and modern environment that we are finding ourselves in today. Jazakallah for listening, and thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you.